This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. And it is also a place where I get to talk to people that I love and writers that write books that I love. And today, this is really something special because I love Scotland, and so I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper Lexi Elliott, and the name of her book is About Bright and Deadly Things. It is a fantastic book. Hi, Lexi.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, it's a thrill for me, I can tell you. I was worried, would you have still a Scottish brogue, or are you now very Oxford and very poshy?
I think there's quite a lot of Scots still in my accent, particularly if I've had a glass of wine.
Oh, good. I love it. I love it. I love that I could talk to people from Scotland all day long. I'm one of those people who love bagpipes. I mean, I have bagpipes on my morning playlist.
Wow, you know, that is something.
I mean, it's just, it perks me up, you know, it puts a smile on my face. And I was so thrilled when I got you. I had been worried that I wouldn't be able to get you on, because, of course, your writing is fantastic, but you are everything that I just admire so much, not only from Scotland, you went to Oxford, and well, when I was a little girl, I dreamt about it. I visited many times. I'm one of those people I can say, I've been to Oxford. I've been there many times. Wow. You are an amazing person.
Oh, thank you. That's so kind of you to say.
Well, I'm going to let you do most of the talking so I can hear your accent. I just want you to know why I love Scotland so much. When our very first trip, my husband and I flew up there, and we rented a car, and we immediately headed for a town where I had made reservations because it was not far from where John Paul Jones was born, and I wanted to visit that. And so we started off in one of those little cars with the steering wheel on the wrong side, and I keep saying I want to go to Kirkcudbright. Where is Kirkcudbright? Do you know, people would send me no kidding. I would go here, the left. All these wonderful people along the side of the road were so helpful. They must have had so much fun sending us in circles. So pronounce it.
Yeah, there's quite a few places that have interesting pronunciation that doesn't exactly match the spelling, but Kirkcudbright is one of them.
Anyway, we loved it, and we went back many, many times to Scotland. And mostly we stayed in Edinburgh at the George, so I know it well. Wow,
lovely place.
A lovely place. So tell us, well, we'll talk first about the book, but then I want to talk about Oxford. So the new book is called Bright and Deadly Things, and that is also something I love. It's set in the Alps. And it's a reading retreat, which, I mean, you know, that's like my dream place. So everything about this book I found fascinating. Of course, it's very suspenseful. You're a great writer. And I love the cover. I just love to look at it. Bright and Deadly Things with a very bright cover.
It is set in the Alps. You're absolutely right. And in fact, I am in the Alps right now because it happens to be half term for my children. So we're on a short skiing break in the Alps.
Oh, whoa. I should have come and done an interview over there with you.
Yeah, that would be fun.
So tell us about this idea for our great mystery at a reading retreat. What a wonderful place to kill people off.
Well, yeah, the idea came to me because I had been invited in the year 2000 when I was doing my doctorate to exactly this reading retreat out in the French Alps, where three Oxford colleges have a chalet called Chalet des Anglais. And I spent a lovely week there back in the year 2000, and absolutely nobody died. But, you know, it really stuck in my mind as being quite a special place. And I loved the atmosphere of it and the fact that it was very rustic, no running water, no electricity. And so when I came to think about setting a thriller in Oxford Academia, I wanted to do something a little different than the regular campus thriller. And I thought about the chalet, and that's how I came to set it there. So the premise of the story is that we meet Dr. Emily Rivers, whose husband has unfortunately recently died, and she is struggling with grief and handling her new situation without her husband by her side. And she accepts an invitation to go out to this chalet for a week with a group of people, some of whom she knows and some of whom she doesn't, and they're drawn from different levels of university life, from undergraduates through to quite senior professors. And even before she gets out there, she experiences a break-in at her home. And when she gets there, she finds that there's tensions within the group and some mysterious goings-on, and the chalet itself seems to have quite a dark history. And she has to figure out how this relates to herself and potentially her husband, because it's beginning to look rather fraught for her, shall we say.
Oh, yes, rather. And you write so beautifully. Your characters, your words. Of course, I wouldn't expect less from somebody who's gone to Oxford, but you know, you have that real insight and talent to draw out the characters and to paint a picture and to make us wish we were right there along for the ride. And we are when we're holding the book in our hands.
Well, that's the power of books, isn't it? But that's very lovely to hear you say it. But yes, it's an escapism, isn't it? And I particularly like to write thrillers that have a very strong setting, because I think that's something that I enjoy myself in my reading, and it's a world I want to inhabit while I'm writing as well, that there's a strong sense of setting, a strong sense of atmosphere, that something that I find really intriguing and I'm happy to go back to every day.
And you know, when we're talking about a suspense book, it's so important that you really have to fine-tune it so that you keep the reader constantly a little bit on edge, wondering where exactly they're going. You have a device in here. You have a clock, which also gives us this ominous feel of time and space and what's going to happen as we continue turning the pages.
There isn't actually a clock in the real Chalet des Anglais. So that was definitely an invention of mine. I think it arose initially because I was thinking about, you know, Emily's struggle with grief and her sense that the time that she has allotted on Earth is running out fast. You know, she's very aware of the fact that she is stuck in a rut and really needs to get hold of her life. And I think the clock became sort of a physical manifestation of that sense. But also the clock itself seemed to want to build out its part and became, by the end of the novel, it represents much more than that. And obviously there's no spoilers, so I won't go into more detail on that. But I think you'll find that the clock is quite meaningful in the story.
It is, definitely. And yet we're not going to give any spoilers, because part of the fun of any book is this reveal as we go along, as we peel away the layers and find out what's happening. But now with this clock, as you said, it there isn't one there yet, but now I think you're going to have to donate one
What a good idea.
Yeah, you're going to have to find a real lovely antique one and donate it and put it, you know, they'll put a plaque there for you. So, you know, for hundreds of years from now, Oxford people will still be coming there and they'll see your clock, right?
That is an excellent idea. I shall have to work on that one.
Well, I'm sure it would be welcomed and they will be proud of you because I'm sure they're having fun reading the book too. All, you know, it's so amazing. I was just talking to Cassandra Clare, and she spoke recently at the Oxford Union. She was invited. She's an author, a young adult. She, you know, wrote a series of books called The Shadow Hunters, and
that's right.
So she was invited to speak there, and of course she was so thrilled. There is something. You know, it's just for I think for all writers, of course, you know, anybody who loved Lord Peter Wimsey, Oxford is the place. And certainly for, I know for Cassandra, it was like a goal in your life that you can't even imagine that you get to speak there. But I don't know. Have you spoken there?
Not at the Union, no. I suppose I've given various presentations in various lecture halls through the course of my PhD studies. It would be quite different to go back there as an author, I suppose, because whilst I was there, I was studying physics and then theoretical physics, which is very different to, obviously, what I do now.
Well, you know, it's just so much fun to think about. Well, as I said, I lived in England for quite a while. I was a Jane Austen fan as a child. When I was 11, I decided to move to England to live near where she was born. So I moved to Sonning. I bought a cottage, a 400-year-old cottage in Sonning. I lived there. That's near Henley. And so a trip up to Oxford was... it was always, you know, on a lovely weekend, mostly because there were so wonderful, wonderful secondhand bookstores that I could find books.
Oxford is beautiful, and I've been really fortunate this year to go back quite a few times for friends' weddings, and I had a reunion at University College, and I've actually got one at New College coming up soon. So I've had quite a few trips down memory lane recently, and you know, Oxford just is pretty special. The architecture, the people, that it just has a feeling. You can't really escape the sense of history there.
Oh, it's just to walk the streets, to get to, you know, look in some of the buildings, and of course, as I said, the bookstores, they're secondhand bookstores that are just a joy for a book lover.
Yes, and one of the pleasures of my life is having my book be in the Blackwell's bookstore in Oxford. You know, when my debut novel, The French Girl, was published, I was so excited to see it in there. That was just a highlight for me.
Well, and The French Girl is fantastic, too. I love that. Yes, I can imagine, you know, to go there and see your book. And since you were studying science, you didn't expect to become a novelist?
I always wanted to be. Even from a small child, I really wanted to become a writer. But I suppose that I was fairly pragmatic, too, and I thought I ought to follow a career that was more likely to result in being actually able to pay the bills. So I followed physics instead, and I never really gave up on the dream of it. I was writing short stories in my spare time, not that there was a lot of that when I started working in the city. But I lost my job in the global financial crisis, as many people did in the financial industry, and that was the point at which I found myself with a little bit of extra time on my hands, and I thought, maybe I'll give this novel writing a try. And ultimately, I, after a good many years, produced The French Girl, and that set me on the path that I am now.
Wow, that's wonderful. Well, see, good things do come out of financial crisis sometimes, and out of the pandemic, a lot of people did, knuckle down and start writing. You know, after years of saying they were dreaming of writing, and they actually did. So we're getting some new authors who are emerging now as a result of the pandemic. Now, for you, since you were, studying science, what is your literary background? What, of course, in Oxford, you studied, took literature classes, you studied the great works, or what? How exactly did you study in Oxford?
So, universities in the UK are quite different to the US. So, if you go to study physics, that will be all you do, physics and any math that you need for physics. There's no such thing as an undeclared major. You are accepted onto a particular academic course, and that's all you do. So, there wasn't an option for me to study any English literature whilst I was at Oxford. It's just not how the system works. I did a lot of English at school, and I read voraciously. I have always read quite a lot in a very wide-ranging, right across the genres, shall we say. And I honestly think that reading is the best path into writing. I think you should read anything and everything, and then perhaps start thinking about taking some courses about the craft. And the combination of the intuition that sort of you gather from all the reading as to how things should be set out and where you need the pace to improve, where you need the beats and so forth, that can be reinforced by the lessons on craft that you take. And then after that, there's no substitute for just getting your bottom of the seat and knuckling down and writing.
Exactly. Now, let's just talk for a few minutes. We don't have a lot of time. I could talk to you for hours. But just tell us about your childhood, where you were raised and how a little bit about your childhood.
So I grew up at the foot of the Highlands in Scotland, a very little village called Braco. And I went to a primary school that had 28 pupils between the ages of 5 and 12. So very, very small and very much able to cater for individuals because they had to. You know, my year group as such was 4 people. So there were 2 teachers handling all these children. So they had to be very good at, allowing people to work at their own pace, which worked very well for me because I was interested in reading voraciously. I was also very mathematical, and they allowed me to go ahead and so forth. And I swam a lot outside of school because that wasn't offered at a state school, which is what I was at there. And I loved it. I really loved Scotland. There's something about the landscape which I think just hints of mystery and myth and legend, and you really do believe that there could be Selkies in the cave on the coast and so forth. It's just crying out for that kind of imagination, and I really enjoyed setting my second book, The Missing Years, in Scotland because it was very much set in the area that I grew up in, and it felt like an homage to that.
Oh, I know, we drove quite a bit in the Highlands, and I might have gone through your village, I don't know. But I love it up there, and I love, we just had so much fun. Of course, one of the things, we had friends who had a, they smoked salmon, so they were always a destination spot for us. Because there is nothing like smoked Scottish salmon, so
absolutely.
Oh, it's a wonderful place to visit. I'm hoping that now that people can start traveling again, because I had heard, actually, you know, for Scotland, it was a rough time, tourist-wise, you know, during the pandemic, and some, you know, of the hotels practically closed down, and I hope that people will start going there again, because it's just so beautiful.
It is so beautiful, but you're right. They had quite a hard lockdown, shall we say. I do think that things are pretty much back to normal. My dad and my sister still live in the area I grew up in, so I'm back there fairly frequently, and things do seem to be recovering.
Well, I'm happy, and I just hope so much that people can get up to Scotland, because sometimes people think, well, you know, it's out of the way from, if they making a trip, they'll go to London. But boy, oh boy, that trip to Scotland, to stay in Edinburgh for a little while, and to then get to, you know, the Highlands, it's fantastic. Now, again, the new book is great. I love it. I was really just taken with the whole storyline. We don't want to give anything away, but people, it is really it's a great mystery. It's a great suspense. And it's called Bright and Deadly Things. And the cover is so, I love it. I love that cover. Do you frame these covers? Just look at them?
I don't. I obviously have the books on my bookshelf, but you're absolutely right. The art department at Berkeley have completely knocked the ball out of the park on this one. It's gorgeous.
Oh, this one you should absolutely turn into a poster. I would look at that all day long. It just, you know, there we have, oh, the highlight, well, in Switzerland, and we have all the story behind it. So make a poster out of that one for yourself.
Okay.
And do that. Take a picture of yourself standing next to your poster, and then you can put it on Facebook, and we can all see that. How about that?
That sounds like a very good idea.
Okay. And so you have a website, and it is just Lexi Elliott, right?
LexiElliott.com, that's correct.
And two L's, two T's, and right? I think two T's, right?
Yep, two L's, two T's, and Elliott, correct?
Okay, good. Well, Lexi, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. You are an inspiration, I think, to so many people, because, you know, for writers, there's this as you did, you started in some other field. You decided to, you know, well, take a field that you might love, but always in the back of your mind, you knew that you wanted to get something on paper and you wanted to share it. And that's why I call this program Joy on Paper. Because once you get that joy on paper, you know that you're putting words down that people will then read at some point, and they'll say, wow, I needed that story. I needed that break. I needed that afternoon or a few days of just getting away from my own mind and getting into somebody else's a little bit scary mind here in this book. But you have some great ideas in it. So again, Lexi Elliott, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you.
It's been a real pleasure for me. Thank you so much for having me on.
Okay. I'm looking forward to that poster on your Facebook page, okay?
Absolutely.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. We can have a few commercials, and then we're coming back with Valentine advice from somebody who knows and who has been thinking about this for a long time. Let's do...
How could I know this?
No, let's do some commercials. Okay. I don't know.
How to tell you of my heartache. How to tell you I'm not free. Okay.
che lasciandoti.
Bachnick, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Okay, we had a little technical difficulty there, but I am here, and I am Patsy with a Z, and you are Dr. Erica Bachnick, right?
That's right.
Okay, great. It's funny. So it is Valentine's Day. I can't believe it. Really? how did it happen so fast? It's the January just flew by, and we're already Valentine's Day, and you have some expert advice on how to help people. Okay, I'm sorry. Are you there again?
Okay.
I don't want to lose
I'm
you.
Here.
Okay.
I'm here.
All right. So let's talk about your advice for Valentine's Day, because I was looking at it and I thought, well, this, you put some deep thought into this and come up with some great ideas.
Thank you so much. I do think about love all the time. It is my life's work. It is my life's passion. I'm raising three children. I'm a family therapist, a professor. I am a researcher studying what makes families healthy and strong. And the conclusion I've come to after decades of doing this work is that love is truly the answer.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we've been hoping that people would get this message finally. With all the things that have been happening in this world recently, the tensions, the stress, going through the pandemic, and I do hope that people learn something, at least from the pandemic, that love is important. And if we could only, looking back in American history, back to the 60s and 70s, and it was all love, 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 and then something happened. I don't know what happened. But you explain what you want people to think about here for Valentine's Day and what we can do to put love back into our lives.
You're hitting on something so important that I just want to touch on for a moment, and it's that we really reflect on the word love so often and think of it in very trite ways. We think of pink hearts and red roses and affection and dates. And you're right that there have been movements all throughout history, including a lot of really important voices like bell hooks and others, really talking about love as so much broader of a concept, really thinking about love as the glue and that binds people together and as the very core of what it means to be human. So what I hope people will do on Valentine's Day is seek to understand love as the fabric of healthy living. It bonds people together in healthy relationships. It is fundamental for our good mental health. And we need to teach our children about the power of love. And I love the idea that we have this collective ritual called Valentine's Day when we stop and reflect on what love means in our lives.
And I hope people do take a few minutes, just stop, just sort of chill, just relax for a few minutes and think about it, because everything that's going on around in the world, it can be so overwhelming. And then we read and we hear about this horrific bullying that's going on, the anger that's going on in the streets, the hate. Where exactly, what happened to everybody? As a child, I was so fortunate. I had such a lovely childhood. And all of this, I don't know how the young kids are dealing with it today, because when I was a kid, we lived in beautiful oblivion, I'll tell you right now. We didn't know anything bad. I don't remember anything bad until later on when we moved to the city. But what do people do now with their kids? How do they keep them from hearing all this? When on the cover of newspapers, in the grocery store, you see mother kills this one, and mother kills her son, mother kills this one, son kills... It's overwhelming.
It really can be. And you're really touching on a few different dynamics. And I feel, first of all, that it's a really beautiful thing that you had those early experiences. And it really helps you to see the contrast between what a loving home can look like and what it feels like our kids are being exposed to everywhere. And part of what you're describing is the sheer exposure and the inundation of information in today's world. We are exposed at so much higher rates to the terrible things happening everywhere than we ever were before. But the other piece of it is that with the growing conversation in the world about mental health, one of the downsides is that we've come to define mental health in a very restrictive way and in a very inhuman way. The idea is that our feelings are toxic and we have to get a hold of them and we have to control them and manage them and get calm, at all costs get calm. And there are definitely scenarios where you have to stay calm and suppress your feelings to stay safe. But we can't generalize that. Our feelings are our superpowers. They give us important information about our experiences, and they are meant to be shared between humans. And that's where love really comes in, because when you're in loving relationships, you can think of it as you're cultivating a safe space for all of that emotional information to get shared, and through which you can achieve even deeper connection.
Well, what is some of your practical advice for people to deal with well, not just Valentine's Day, but with love? What, you have some specific ideas on how to, I don't know, make life better?
So it's a couple of things. One, starting with Valentine's Day, think of it as a reset for love. Families get busy. You've likely, if you're a parent, you've conceptualized the role of parenting as very pragmatic, the daily hassles of caregiving. And a lot of parents are living with this existential dread, how to keep our kids safe in this world, how to protect them. And we're hyper-focused on danger and risk and achievement and sort of raising kids to be stoic in this world. And in my mind, we're really hitting all the wrong marks. We need to raise our children to be more human, and that is how they will really change the world for the better. So the practical advice is to create a reset. Think to yourself first, what do I think love is? Now, I think love is showing up as yourself, embracing the other person for all the things that make them special and unique. And so on Valentine's Day, my family and I have a ritual that we write notes to each other and make those messages direct. I wrote my son a heart this morning to tell him that I love his curiosity and all the questions he brings to our conversation. He wrote a note to his sisters that said, "Thank you for always being there for me." These are some ideas our family has about love. And when we create these rituals where we're really intentional about it, we start a habit that can persist over every day in the long term. I think of it like creating that foundation. That's what my ability is in this crazy world, is to make their foundation strong. And from that perch, from that foundation, they will be able to respond with love to all of the stress that comes their way.
So your ritual is, you have a family dinner on Valentine's Day?
We have a family dinner. We actually were able to have a family breakfast this morning, which sometimes is hard to swing on a busy morning. What I tell families is that a shared family meal seems to really matter. There's a ton of research about this. It's an accessible ritual for many families to make sure you're sitting down together, device and screen free, making conversation, enjoying food, and sitting around the table and looking in each other's eyes and saying loving things. If this is not a ritual that's accessible for you, think about how you can create the meat of that. How do you create a predictable time during the day that your family knows they will be able to connect for a minimum of 10 minutes over some sort of a shared interest? Food is a great uniter, but there's certainly many other things that you can think about connecting around, like favorite music or talking about the day's events on the news together, there's lots of ways to create connection points.
Now, one of the problems, of course, when you mentioned turning off devices, people are really, they're outrageous. I it's so prevalent wherever you go, people are just on their devices in the restaurant, and they're sitting with people.
Yeah, these are terrible habits, and actually my kids are experiencing this in their friendships too. My children don't have cell phones, and a lot of their friends do, and they're often sitting there at the table with no one to talk to. It's a really difficult thing. What I would say in the format of this conversation and briefly here is that I really encourage adults to not think about it as like either or, right? That the phone is entirely toxic and you have to totally disengage. I think it's really important to recognize that people are not always choosing to be that engaged with their phone. They, you know, the workplace has changed, and many of us have bosses who expect us to be on call. We coordinate parts of our children's lives and our own social lives through the phone. So it can really be a challenge to make big, sweeping choices about phone use. Instead, think about creating that ritual where there is a period of time when you are simply not engaged with the phone, and accept that to some degree, the phone has become an integrated part of many of our lives. You can only do so much to downscale, in other words, and you can make those cuts where you can, but the other piece of it is really being intentional about some shared time without it.
So you write about giving children the opportunity to be loving. How do you do that? How do you encourage children to be loving?
Yes, this is so important. Children have to know their impact. And parents have to show up as whole people. That's how you grow a relationship. You can't just be a robot who's there to serve. You have to be a full human. And what that shows children, first of all, is that you mean it when you say, I'm in this life with you. But it also gives them opportunities to understand the impact they can make on others. And once they know that they have the capacity to really impact through love, they can also see the flip side, that their words can hurt, and they can choose how to impact their relationships. So in as much as I'm giving my children loving messages on this day, I'm giving them to write those notes, to give love. When they give me love, I let them know what a gift that is, that I cherish it. We make it a practice, in other words, to share love, as opposed to a single direction act of caregiving that only I can do.
When you're working with families, what do you advise them to do now nowadays? Do like retreats help? I know that for writers, and I've been talking to a lot of writers, that they've discovered how wonderful a writing retreat is for them to calm them, to get them focused. In the old days, the families used to vacation together. I don't know if they're doing that as much anymore.
It's a really great question, and I do think for a lot of families, vacationing or a weekend away or a staycation can make a huge impact on family bonding. But actually, something that I think is really important is to embrace the life that you have and learn how to integrate connection into your life, as opposed to creating that kind of bifurcation that love can only exist in these rare moments like a vacation.
So it's an everyday thing. It's an everyday thing,
and it's even an every moment thing. When parents are in times of struggle with their kids, for example, what they're often looking for from me when they convo with me as a therapist is they're looking for a tactic, a strategy, a control strategy, or way that they can get power over the child. They don't think of it that way, but that is what they're looking for. How do I control the behavior? And what I really try to help them reframe is that when a problem comes up, you are two people who are stuck. And how do you get on the same team? That's a way to integrate connection and love, even into the moments where what you would be doing is problem solving together, as opposed to, you know, celebrating with joy all of your shared interests. Love is all of these things. Love is the way that we connect, and we can connect in difficult moments.
Well, I loved when my kids were young that we did things. Well, I was a homeschool mom, so we did things together that all of us could experience. For example, when we were studying the Civil War, we went to battlefields all across, you know, the different states. And when we were studying presidents, we'd take a trip and we would go to presidents' houses. And, you know, and we also were in the little theater together. We would participate in things where we were all doing the same thing and sharing sort of all of these experiences. And that, I think, was just a fantastic thing. And I think more people should try to do things like that with their kids that are not, you know, not theme parks. I didn't mean to, like, take a vacation to a theme park. To take not so much educational, but just something where you're all sort of working together on an idea. And nowadays, I think it's wonderful if parents would get together. And if you're going to, it's so nice. There's a program called Scrivener, a writing program where everybody in the family can write a chapter about an event they go to. If they all go to the same event, but they can all write their own little story and make it into a chapter in a book. And after a few years, they have a complete book that they can, you know, save and have as something that will be a treasure for the family. But again, where they all work together on sort of the same idea at the same time, I think that's a wonderful thing to do.
I love what you're describing so much. I think these kinds of projects, especially if they have that kind of long-term rootedness, are really wonderful opportunities for families to connect and teach each other and learn from each other and learn together. And when you learn something at the same time, that can be a wonderful opportunity for relationship development.
Well, and I think if you do things like that, for example, just to take a trip to a cabin in Blue Lake, Quebec, where we used to go. Now, at first, kids will say, well, what are we going to do there? Well, first of all, it's nice that they don't get any cell reception. but the nice thing is if you say, well, you know, let's each of us do this story, and it can be, you can dictate it, you can nowadays, you can videotape it, you can make your own little movie of what we experience in this vacation or this getaway. So again, and if you do something like that and you do it year after year, you really, again, have a family video that you can put together.
I think that that's lovely. Great idea.
Are you there?
They cut her off.
Oh, no. They cut her off. Oh, my goodness. Okay, I kept her a little longer than they had said. She is doing a tour, and she is wonderful. Her name is Dr. Erica Bochneck, and I will be putting up some information on my Facebook today about her, and you can look into that. But again, what she's saying is love, you know, what can we do? Oh, maybe they're going to bring her back. I just wanted to finish up with her. Okay, you're back, Dr. Erica.
Sorry, where did we get cut off?
I don't know. But I just wanted to say that I know you're doing this tour, and is there a way people can contact you?
Please. You can find me on Instagram at Dr. Erica with a K, C-O-N-V-O, Dr. Erica Convo. And also the website, myconvo.org. You can make a direct appointment.
Okay, myconvo, how do you spell that?
myconvo.org.
Just myconvo.org. Org. Okay, and they can make an appointment and they can talk to you about love and about how to bring that into their life and into their families' lives. And thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. It's been a joy to talk to you. And you're finding the joy in helping people to find love.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you. And same to you. Happy Valentine's Day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. I will put that up on my website. So, and also Facebook today, later on. Ideas. Coming out with ideas for Valentine's Day. That's great. Now, one of the things I want to do, I just want to, I've been talking a lot about these writers' retreats lately. It just seems to be coming up all the time. And over the years, I've reminded you that one of the things to do is keep a journal. And keeping a journal, well, some people have kept journals for their entire lives, but one of the things that it's really helpful, because as you see here, I talked to Lexi Elliott. She wasn't really planning to be a novelist. She was studying science. But here, she turns out to be a great and now a famous novelist. And if you have a journal, if you've kept a journal of your life, and it's really helpful. And I was reminded of the importance of a journal because Andrea Hiotis, who is a fan of Joy on Paper, has been doing a journal about Joy on Paper. She listens to the program and she journals it. My goodness, I am so thrilled and I'm so honored that she would do that. Andrea is an absolutely delightful, delightful person. I think of her as one of the treasures of Joy on Paper that I got to meet her, and she is so interesting and she is so just a fantastic person. She's an artist. She illustrates books. She works at Michelle's. There's a wonderful, wonderful candy store. It's called Michelle's, and it is in Newport Richey, and it is just fantastic. And Andrea works there. You can find some of her cards that she draws, and you can buy them there. You can stop in and see her right there. You know, of everybody I can think of, because Andrea is so sweet, it is so perfect that she would work in a chocolate store. It's hard work, though. I know, because I used to own one. Oh, well, 8 of them. So it's hard work, but she works there, and she's always smiling. She's always cheerful. And you can commission her to do a drawing for you. So stop by Michelle's, and while you're there, because Michelle's is, it's an amazing chocolate store, they have hot chocolate bombs. Now, if you haven't had a hot chocolate bomb, you have missed out on life. This is an amazing thing. It's a chocolate bomb. You put in hot milk or water, and it just bursts open, and it is hot chocolate. It's amazing. It's fantastic. And it is created right there at Michelle's in Newport Richey. So take a trip up there. And they also have online. They sell these online, so you can check them out online. And it's called Michelle's. And you would love it. You will love it. And you get to meet Andrea. And again, Andrea, thank you so much. I know she's listening to this. Now she's going to be journaling hot chocolate bombs, which was great. I love it. And it's beautiful. Just go to the website and look at them. And once you look at them, you're going to buy them. And if you ever want a nice day out, if you're living in the area, it's a wonderful place to go. Again, wonderful, and I just want to thank Andrea for that. I want to also thank Bill Larson. Bill Larson's going to be on in 2 weeks, and he is taking intellectual property questions and getting ready to answer them. So if you have a question, because there has been some startling news about people really cheating and trying to steal, and I mean, like, if you just put some effort into it, people, you can write your own books. You don't have to go and steal people's books. So it's going to be fun to have Bill Larson here. And he is absolute expert on intellectual property. He belongs to APLA, which is the organization for the best intellectual property lawyers. And you can find him at Larson & Larson. Just go to the internet, Larson & Larson, and he will be happy to talk to you and give you ideas on what you need to do to protect your intellectual property. And I also want, just for a moment, to thank, in addition to Andrea, I want to thank Bria Burton, who was the guest host here last week. She was fantastic. And Rita Moreau and Devon Miller, who do Book Buzzes, they are both going to come back, and they are going to do another guest hosting gig. They love it, and they're so good at it, and I'm so proud of them. And special thanks also, getting ready for the 8th anniversary. I'm thanking all of the people who made it possible, including, it's just going to be fantastic. It's going to be a really wonderful show, to thank everybody. I'm going to just play one song on my way out of here. It's a very important song. I want to take a moment to also thank Irene Goodman, who was my first guest on Joy on Paper all the way back almost 8 years ago, and Carol J. Perry, who was my first guest here in the studio. And it makes it so heartwarming to think of all of the wonderful people who have helped me, and of course most especially Big Ed in the control room, because he's so sweet and he's saluting me. And we're going to play a song, a very special song, on my way out. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
But hold out and do it.